ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Blackfella humour has always been our secret weapon. Passed down through generations, sharpened by experience, and wielded with deadly precision. Hello and welcome to Away, Indigenous Art and Culture on ABC Radio National. I'm Rudy Bremer. Black humour is both celebration and shield. A powerful way we've processed our experiences and maintained our cultural strength. Today, you'll hear from three extraordinary voices shaping First Nations comedy. Voices exploring how our humour carries cultural knowledge, challenges stereotypes, heals wounds, and reminds us that our capacity for joy remains undiminished and gloriously our own. Kevin Capinieri, a veteran comedian who's been making audiences laugh for decades. Jaunty Blair, the big black and deadly nurse turned comedian. And Dr. Angelina Hurley, the first Aboriginal PhD graduate from Griffith University Film School, whose doctoral work includes scripts for an Aboriginal comedy series titled Reconciliation Rescue. Then coastal punk rock band Betty Rays brings you some live music. Stay with me here on Away. Aboriginal comedians have been transforming pain into punchlines for generations. And our mob's joy isn't just resistance. It's our birthright. Laughter is what binds us. Last year, I wanted to have a discussion with three instrumental black comedians and storytellers about black humour, and to take the temperature on where the Aboriginal comedy landscape is right now. So, I called in the big guns and was joined by Kevin Capinieri, Jaunty Blair, and Angelina Hurley. Angelina kicked us off. It was actually her writing in the Griffith Review that sparked this whole conversation. So, I wanted to ask her first, why has humour been so important to her as a source of strength?
Yeah, my father was pretty eccentric sort of fellow, and everyone who knows him knows that he was a bit of a laugh, as an understatement. But Mum comes from Cherbourg, so there's a history of living under oppression there. And, you know, their eras of living, and Dad's was in the 60s in Brisbane when there was the, you know, as a teenager in the borders and blackfellas weren't allowed in the city. So their reaction to all sort of hardship and discrimination and racism and stuff like that was also met with the usual emotions of anger. But we always laugh through stuff and we're very resilient. And, you know, it comes from having a thick skin as a blackfella and be able to laugh in the face of, you know, hardship and, yeah, negative stereotypes and all of that sort of stuff. You know, all my family, like, but I don't know a blackfella who's not funny, I don't think, really. You know, it's in our genes.
Sometimes I think I am the blackfella that's not funny.
True.
I mean, yeah, yeah. I think I'm one of those people that I do things that will make you laugh. I didn't mean to, though.
Okay. Yeah, that's good.
Jaunty, you come from a nursing background and you have also started to work as a comedian, which I know is a label that you sort of find a little bit awkward occasionally. When you were working as a nurse and seeing people in their most vulnerable moments, how did humour function as a form of healing?
Humour enabled me to get through 12-hour shifts, on-call shifts, and working and looking after people that I never would have normally come across in my everyday life. You know, situations like the first time I saw a bicillin needle, I had to give someone, you know, a shot of bicillin. It was massive. It was huge. It was milky white. And their big mundi was in front of me. And all I could think of was, oh, my God, this is going to hurt me more than it hurts you. Like, you have to see the humour in every situation. And even when fathers are fainting on you and the baby's being born and thinking, just kick him under the bed, you know, he's not helping me very much here in this situation. I think nursing and midwifery, being the only Black nursing student back in the early 80s in Rockhampton, very racist place to live and be in and work in, being the only Black nurse, you know, or only nurse in the whole place, not even registered nurses. I had to have a sense of humour to get through everything because there were so many funny situations, but also hurtful situations. But I used humour to gravitate, you know, situations where they were quite racist, and being able to see the funny side of everything and laugh at it, and being able to get people to laugh along with you is very powerful.
I wonder what changes when you are thinking about humour professionally, whether it's writing about humour academically or whether it's writing a joke for the stage. How do you see the way that your humour shifts?
I learned to be funny because I went through a lot of rejection as a kid. So for me, when you make someone smile or laugh, it makes their defences come down. Now, I've done a lot of work with Jaanti in the last couple of years since she's won Deadly Funny. I've had the pleasure of doing some radio with you, Angelina. But I think for me, it's like making people feel warm and welcome in your show. Like when I first started my shows, I didn't know my craft that well. So it was like a little bit of roasting and tongue-in-cheek roasting and taking the mickey out of people that, you know, in a loving way. But the more I've matured as a comedian and found my way, I like to make people feel warm and welcome in my show. So I'll literally look at people and connect with them and yarn with them. And I think if there's something in the room, always address it in love and make people feel warm and welcome in your shows. Now, that's how I do it now. In my first 5 years of doing comedy, I was pretty ruthless. I was known for tearing tongue-in-cheek, having to go at a lot of my family and friends. And I don't do that anymore, as you know, Jaanti. But I do make people feel warm and welcome. And, you know, in comedy and making people laugh is such a gift. So whether I'm doing it on stage, and you know this, Jaanti, we tour a lot together, I'm always making people laugh.
Oh, and he's always frightening me. Like he hides in cupboards and under stairwells and in behind curtains and jumps out. And he soon learnt that when we were in Edinburgh that I scare quite easily. And so he'd be hiding under bar stools and behind things and jump out, like in the dressing room. So, Kev makes you laugh even before the show starts.
Yeah, that's true, because we lather ourselves up backstage, like metaphorically speaking.
Metaphorically.
You know, I don't want people giving people visuals there. What are they doing? It's about acting silly backstage for me. That's my approach. And I lather myself up in a silly, by the time I cross that threshold behind the curtain, I'm already in that zone.
Yes.
And you see it happen all the time, Jaanti, you know.
Yeah, I see it happen all the time.
And you go out and you just punch it. You know?
Yeah, I think what Kevin does, and he always says this to me, is elevate, 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 and elevate with love and kindness and compassion and being a newbie in the scene too. And when I won 2022 Deadly Funnies, I said to Kevin afterwards, I said, Kev, did you think I was going to win? He goes, no, Jaanti, I didn't. And I said, neither did I.
I had picked Gavin Semple.
Yeah, he picked someone else.
I picked Gavin Semple to win. Yeah. And Gavin is a very young, funny young brother.
He was.
But I'm so, I mean, Jaanti, you know, you've had a meteoric rise in comedy. And it's because you've got decades of life experience behind you, and you're amazing, you're funny, and it's been such a pleasure to sow into your comedy, pour into your comedy, and to see you rise the way you have has been amazing. And I'd encourage you, Angelina, you need to step up.
Yes, Angelina.
I know, everyone keeps trying to make me do it. I just like telling yarns, you know, that's all. Oh, true to God. I started writing it because I just wanted to write down all these funny family yarns so we don't forget them and we don't forget the people who were involved in them, you know. Yeah. It's sort of like an influence from my dad's art where his purpose was to immortalise Indigenous people so they're not forgotten and combat the erasure of our existence, you know. Like, and we have role models and famous people and community members who might not be celebrities, but they're the, you know, they're important to us.
They are celebrities.
Yeah, and our communities and our families, and they shouldn't be forgotten either, and they should be remembered. And so my first story was, you know, a Wamba story about my grandmother resuscitating a chicken in the floods, her favourite chicken. And I just wrote it out, and it was became really popular. And I didn't know what to write about. And Dad said, "Oh, write that yarn about Nan resuscitating that chicken." And it was just, you know, funny. And I could have written a hardship story of her being broke and having eight kids and you know, being living in the 50s and all of that hardship stuff. But that's not how we remembered her, you know. And we laughed about her and her circumstance. So that was just the purpose of why I started doing it.
You've got the yarns. All you got to do is learn how to structure it and get those good advice from other comedians about how do you develop that yarn and take it to the stage. So you've got all the wealth of knowledge.
Okay, this is a question for you guys because I get bored telling stories all the time too. Mm-hmm. So do you get bored educating people?
No, never. I don't get bored educating people because I don't think about it as educating. I think about it is sharing who I am, my stories, learning who they are. And so to me, and I think it happens too, Sissy, when you turn 60 and you realise you're in your third act, so there's no dress rehearsal. It's like it's all downhill now. And like every day, I don't even have to have an accident to injure myself. I just have to reach down for a pen I've dropped on the floor and I've got a torn ligament, you know. So it's, I don't see it like that. I think I see it and sometimes you go on stage and you share the same stories over and over again. When you've got black people, that's what I really love. When you've got mob in the audience, it's so refreshing. It's so wonderful because sometimes I'll do crowds like the other 2 weeks ago and I said, any mob in the house tonight? And there was not one single, you know, or stamp your feet or, and then I said, any allies in the house? And the whole place erupted. So do you know what I mean? And that came from asking any mob. And then I want the allies to know that, like Kev said, when you get that thing. And
see,
the allies,
I'm too skeptical for that.
I've learned to roll with the waves. And I did a comedy show last year and I did a joke and this woman yelled out from the front row and everyone was drinking. Mm. She goes, "Oh, that wasn't a very funny joke," really loud, right? And I looked over at her and I walked over to her and I said, "Oh, hello, darling. What's your name?" And she said, "Julie." It's my mum. I said, "That's my mum's name." I said, "Security to the front row." Well, everyone, the laughter erupted. Afterwards, she come up and hugged me and loved me up. And I think that's what I do. You're going to get hecklers, but I sort of send, like Kev goes, I sort of send love out. I'm always sending, because Kev always says before the show, the more love you show the comedians, the more love they'll show back to you.
When you are on stage, how are you balancing getting laughs with delivering important messages?
It's all about structure. For me, if you're not funny, be interesting. Right? Because people are still tuned in if you're interested.
Yes.
Right? So me, I try and I do, and you know, and when you come to a live show, I pump out 4 laughs a minute. But I've structured that. I've learnt that over the years. Less dialogue, word economy, get to the punch as quick as possible. So when people are like, "I'm rapid fire," boom, 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 laugh, 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 you know. So it's good to, but the thing is, it's just a common touch, right? Funny, you'll find, and this is when I realised I was funny, when I was travelling through Europe, right, and I'm doing comedy, like I'm coming off the back of Edinburgh and I do stand-up comedy, but away from the stage, I'm funny.
Mm.
And I'm meeting people in second and third languages of English, you know, and I had a pub in Cologne, Germany, laughing, right? I went to Asia. I had everybody in the pub laughing. Funny is funny. Mm. So it doesn't matter where you come from. You know what I mean? Unfortunately, and I see this in a good way, fortunately, I'm a proud Aboriginal man and I get to bring big laughter to the mob and non-Indigenous people. And the older I get, the less colour I see. Yeah. You know, I'm just beginning to love more. And this is my mum speaking now. He's passed away 7 years ago, which is okay because now I save a bit of money on Mother's Day. But my family, my sisters hate that joke. Well, I think it's funny. And I know Mum would be laughing at
yeah,
that.
Yeah, she would be.
And but that's my mum. My mum said to me always, Kev, when you walk in love, you walk in power.
Yes.
And then what is love? And then because Mum would flog you with Bible verses all the time you come and visit her. Mm. And she goes, love is patient, love is kind, love is never jealous. And when she was saying these things, I'm like, so when you're patient with a redneck, you're literally loving them. Mm. And then you're walking in power. When you're kind to people that don't deserve your kindness, yeah, you're actually loving them and you're walking in power.
Yeah, I got to speak to Aunty Lillian Holt. She's the first person who started writing academically about humour, Aboriginal humour, and she famously said in her writings, doing it academically killed the humour in her. She started at Melbourne Uni and then ended up going over to Flinders, but she never finished. But I got to speak to her before she passed, God bless her. And, she goes, someone's got to write it, Angelina, write it out. Go on. And I said, yeah, okay. And it was really hard. It was a bit difficult, you know, writing creatively to writing academically. It is boring.
Yeah.
But I rather like it now. It's sort of really interesting. I really like it. But I'd rather write creatively, of course, and just keep telling my family funny yarns, you know.
That's a blessing. And sister, I love what you do. I love what you do.
Oh, thank you. I was given a lecture. They get students and so they get you to come in and talk about your PhD because they're just starting them to, and they're pretty shocked and surprised at what you do as a PhD, because I remember years ago I was thinking about doing it and I met this brother in a festival and he was sitting there on this bench and he was writing, and I reckon, well, it's a gig, man. It's a festival. What are you doing? Like with all this paper here. I said, aren't you seeing music or something? He goes, no, I'm doing a PhD. I went, what? He said, I'm doing a PhD on festivals. I said, get the hell out of here.
Oh, wow.
No way. That can't be allowed. He said, yeah, I just travel around to festivals and writing about it. I said, what a scam. Oh, my God. He goes, Angelina, if you ever do a PhD, do something fun. And I was like, oh, he's right.
Yeah, if it's going to take over your life the way that a PhD does, you better enjoy it.
Yeah.
You're listening to Away, Indigenous Arts and Culture on Radio National. If you've just joined me, I've been diving headfirst into the world of First Nations comedy with Kevin Capinieri, Jaunty Blair, and Dr. Angelina Hurley. A little earlier, I'd asked about the balance between getting laughs and telling truths. For Kevin, it's a balance that's been hard fought. And just a warning, you are about to hear some racist language.
When I first broke into the mainstream comedy scene, I went and done a 4 years of doing comedy for the mob and then breaking into the mainstream comedy scene and then starting to get a non-Indigenous following was awesome. But I was touring through WA and then I was coming off stage and people said, oh, yeah, you're a very funny abbo. You're a good abbo. You're one of the good ones.
Mm-mm.
I said, oh, yeah, I know a few abbos. And I was like, hold on. I was always saying, this is wrong. So you don't talk to people like that.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, that's a very highly offensive word to Aboriginal people. Don't say it. And then I was like, hold on. I've got a platform now. So I developed a joke about abbo. And I had to construct it first because I wanted to get the message out on stage so I didn't have to deal with that crap off stage. You know, so I started developing about Aboriginal nicknames, you know, like my Uncle Toidy, T-O-I-D-I, and I give you the quick crash version. Toidy, what does that mean, Mum? Because it just means idiot backwards, you know. and then we give each other nicknames and language in Ngarajiri. I have an Auntie Titty Eye, and I said, Mum, what does Auntie Titty Eye mean? She's just when she runs, her titties hit her in the eye, right? So And then I love you white people. I love you guys. I study you guys on documentaries and stuff. Yeah. I love you,
yeah.
You know.
And then
I said, but you got gammon, bland nicknames. Simpson, Simo, Dixon, Dicko, Johnson, Jono. I was like, what would Tony Abbott's nickname be? And they're like, don't say it. Don't say it. I can't stand that word.
Don't say it.
And then everyone's laughing. And I thought, we'd be so the first good. Abbo to be prime minister. Right? And then everyone's laughing. And then I said, but reality is, then I shift it back again. And goes, the reality is it's a very highly offensive word for Aboriginal people. Yeah. And then I go into that whole quick dialogue. And now because you guys are such an intelligent, and you put it back on the crowd, you guys are such an intelligent, beautiful people. And then I said, by way of applause, do you guys agree with me? Clap. Mm. And then you're coming off stage and people saying, oh, I didn't realise it was offensive. So it was a different, but I developed that joke. I developed that joke to stop having that conversation after shows.
I mean, that is a really good example of a high risk kind of joke. I mean, it clearly had high reward in that you were able to shift people's understanding, but I can see a world in which that goes terribly for you.
Blackfellas laugh at it. They didn't. That was like,
it's interesting.
A lot of people are just the biggest cultural gap in the world is between white Australia and black Australia. Mm. Now, when we done overseas, there was more people overseas that were more aware of our journey here in Australia than white Australians themselves. So, and big love to everybody. I'm just stating a fact because I was having yarns with Scottish, English people that were finger on the pulse. Irish, especially the Irish. For me, it's like I think that's the great leveler. I mean, like, I don't want to ever stop being funny. I mean, for me, it's like people go, oh, you're doing a great job. You're doing this. I'm a comedian and I don't want to stop being funny. But every now and then, whether it be something that happens in the news or something, a bit of unrest in the nation, comedy will lend itself to that particular situation. So then you've got to speak into that through comedy.
I'll just make a comment to what Kev said about he's been doing it for such a long time, 16, 17 years. He punches his joke out. He's very funny. But collectively, Aboriginal Comedy All Stars, I deliver my comedy in a different way. I think I'm a bit more of a storyteller. But what I found is how we balance each other out, because in comedy shows I've learned you can't be laughing. You actually get exhausted. So I do a bit of singing and poetry, and it's a platform for me to share stories of my nursing and midwifery, which I've never done before. This is the very first time people are going to see my humour about, you know, those situations. And what I've learned is that my stories have got humour in them, and they transcend age and nationalities, because it's a story about this Aboriginal nurse who thought that she could be a great nurse and a great midwife, and how those stories transcend. Because I'm very protective of I said to Kevin, is it okay if I talk about something? He goes, as long as you change everyone's name. And I go, okay, I've changed everyone's name throughout my script, you know, and it's still evolving. But what I've also learnt by hanging around Kevin and Shawnee Chilbra and J.Y. Mara and Andy Saunders and Elaine Crombie and Leon Fyle and all the comedians, you know, Kimmy Lovegrove here in Melbourne, is that it's okay to have my way of delivering comedy and my storytelling. But what I've also learned by watching the greats is that I get better by watching my black fellow comedians. There's no one I'd rather be around than my mob when I'm doing comedy.
That's deadly, sister. And you know what? I've got so many beautiful non-Indigenous brothers and sisters out there. I just want to speak, you know, give a quick shout out to Cal Wilson. Mm. She helped me put one of my jokes together.
Wow.
I've worked with Harley Breen, and he taught me about word economy. Harley. Get to the joke fast, Kev.
Wow.
And then I've worked with Jeff Green, UK, based in Australia now. And I was like, this fella is rapid fire, and that's where I got my rapid fire from. That's how I can punch out four big gut laughs a minute, you know, not just chuckles and giggles, but gut laughs, you know. And I learnt watching the best. I learnt watching Dave Thornton when I toured with Dave Thornton. What an amazing host. And I went my first ever Melbourne International Comedy Festival roadshow watching Dave. I mean, this guy is good. And then I was the first on the first year. Let's fast forward 5 years. Now I'm hosting the road shows.
Angelina, your PhD examined how black humour can reshape mainstream perceptions. Do you think comedy offers that genuine pathway?
My creative project for my PhD is called Reconciliation Rescue because it's a satire take on the renovation rescue. And I just thought one day the whole of Australia needs a makeover, not just a community or a house. So that's where that came from. But it's satirical and a parody. It's not serious. But there is seriousness in the way comedy can transform mainstream perceptions and give us empower us as individuals to have the narrative for once and, you know, create an even playing field for those discussions and those hard issues that Kevin and Jaunty were talking about when they arise. Mm. It creates an even playing field for people more comfortable when you're having a laugh and, you know, not that seriousness of our issues and our history doesn't need to be taken seriously, but we have always dealt with it in a different way, and I think it's a more, I want of a better word, it's a better way to cope with it. And then it just humanises us when we've been classed as inhumane for so long. It, even in elections and stuff and talks that I've given, it puts people at ease about the seriousness of, you know, colonisation and those things that have happened to us. So you can see the change on their faces, and I'm sure you guys see it way more than I do because you're on stage every night. Yeah, the change of their faces when you've got a different way of delivering that to them.
The reason I got into comedy 3 years ago is when I was in Byron Bay on a bumble date, and the only people that I could see on stage were white, non-Indigenous female comedians. No one looked like me. I thought, I could do this. I think it's about time. I want to see more people that look like me. And so my first open mic night was at Ballina Shores, and it was completely white. I said, any mob here? Nobody. You know, and I didn't say any allies because that came over time. I said, oh, okay. Oh, well, thank you, Ballina Shores. I've got one word for you. And I said, token, and they erupted with laughter, and that just came about by, I have often felt tokenistic in many situations, and I could turn it around and make a joke of it and laugh about it. But I also think too, and what I've learned is I've had young non-Indigenous men and women come up to me after a show that I've done, go, oh my God, we just love your humour. You're just so funny. We love your smile. We love your content. Thank you so much. And I've had young people from around the world, because when I was doing my first open mics in Brisbane, in bars where it's mainly backpackers, you know, even the Italian 25-year-old backpack. Hey, Jaunty, I love you. You're so funny, you know.
That is a gammon Italian accent. You need to work that. That is so gammon.
I don't know what part of Italy
they're from. I've always been a straight shooter with you, Jaunty. You know?
Cappuccino. Well, how do I say?
You know, I think you need to quit while you're ahead of you, woman. Right? You need to, as black fellas say, shut y'all. Just sit down, relax.
Oh, God.
You know, we've been talking about black comedy, particularly thinking about on the stage, and I know that there's been a huge shift. Like, there are so many more black fellas who are on comedy festival lineups, who are performing, even if I just look 10 years ago. How do you think that is changing or shifting the way that black humour exists in the world?
Like I said, when I first started, it was only Sean.
Mm.
And then for a lot of times, it was just me and Sean. And then Andy started the same time as Sean but had family and couldn't pursue the career. Coming into an absolute white comedy landscape and learning to be funny for non-Indigenous and was a good transition. It took me about 12 to 18 months to really land that well. And then now I can do a gig at the Shangri-La, which I have done. I've done a gig here at the Shangri-La, full of suits, a lot of rich people, a corporate gig, and go on there and smash.
Mm.
And then go down to Gigalong, which I've done, on the lawns of the police station and do a comedy night there. Like, we learn to work through all of that. For me, it's like now we've got so many bookable Aboriginal comedians out there that we're starting to build an Aboriginal comedy landscape. And I've got ideas and I'm sharing them with my colleagues and people I love and trust. And soon there'll be an Aboriginal comedy circuit in Australia. You go to the UK, they've got their own black comedy circuit. And then you want people, black fellas from all over the world, coming to Australia and said, you've got to do the Aboriginal comedy circuit. Mm. That's what we're going to work towards. You know, and then not only that, still keep sowing into Australian comedy. You know, living between both worlds and bringing the funny, because laughter is healing, laughter is fun. And there's something wrong with you if you don't like laughing. You know what I mean? And laughter is such a great way of bringing people together. And I've learned that. And like I said, I'm repeating myself. And the more I get older, the less I see colour.
Hmm.
Yeah. I just love people. But we are very special because we're Aboriginal people from this nation. I always tell fellas, when you come to this country, you don't know the true heartbeat of this country until you connect with the people from this country.
Mm. In studying, there's, you know, I always, my favourite stuff is satire and parody, so I miss all that. The really predominant when I was growing up on TV and, you know, so from the times of from basically Black, the pilot, to Barbecue Area, to after that, because of the, you know, the environment that we live in and the right-wing federal governments and all of that stuff, it, you know, comedy is really responding to that environment that we've had to put up with. So there was a big 20-year gap or more in between the representation of Black comedy on television. There was nothing until... but it always existed in theatre. It's always existed in performance and dance. It's always existed in-house with in the community, yarns and talking, you know, stuff like that. So, but on TV, that is, you know, this revitalization or this re-emergence of it through a few TV shows that started in the 2000s and, of course, when Deadly Funny started. And, yeah, I just hope that there's... Yeah, it just, I don't think I need to hope that it grows. It just will.
It is growing. That's exactly right. And I think, can I just say, Melbourne International Comedy Festival has the biggest lineup of Black performers. And I want to give a shout out to Kayla Lovegrove and Kimmy Lovegrove and I think a Leon, but also Ben Moody, who's a favourite comedian of mine, but also Dane Simpson's got a show. And also shout out to Steph Tisdall, who's been very generous in, you know, elevating my ability to get shows and stuff as well. So I think hopefully we're in a space where we all, if I can't do a gig, then someone else can do it.
And it's happening everywhere, even on the West, over in the far West, the Wild West, over in Perth, and then blackfellas are getting there. They're funny on over there too. And, you know, like every time I go to Perth, man, it's always big crowds. And a shout out to the Melbourne International Comedy Festival. Now, Deadly Funny is Australia's search, run by the Melbourne International Comedy Festival. Deadly Funny is to find Australia's funniest Aboriginal. Now, that's been running this year for 18 years.
Mm.
So you look at all the people that have come out of that. There's been Steph Tisdale, Andy Saunders, myself, I was the second inaugural winner. Dane Simpson, the people that have done it, but
no
haven't
way.
Won, but have done it and have forged careers from it as well.
Yes.
J.Y. Mara, Leon Firewood, national winner. He gets to do his first Melbourne Comedy Festival gala, opening night gala, and welcome to the club, brother. Janie done hers last year for the first time. I've done five. We're all jealous of Andy. Andy's done like nearly 25. I don't know what he's doing down in Melbourne Comedy Festival, get all them galas. No, I think he's done about 8 or 9 and Sean's done heaps. Sean was the first one to do a gala, you know. And so thank you, Melbourne International Comedy Festival. Thank you, everyone down there, Susan, Proven, for championing our people, championing our funny voice throughout Australia and overseas. Mm. They produced the Aboriginal Comedy All-Stars overseas. We went over there. We didn't only think, but we sold out our season.
Yep.
Right? They've put their money where their mouth is. They have come in and said, like, they got us to Edinburgh, you know? And then when we went there, we didn't sell out our show. We sold out our season. 5-star reviews. And the first Aboriginal Comedy All-Stars team was me, Andy and Steph that went to Edinburgh because we couldn't take everybody.
Yeah.
Then we done it a couple of years ago with me, Janti, J.Y. Mara and Sean. And so every time we go back, 5-star reviews, we made it on the BBC with Grant Stott's show. And we kept on selling out. People were coming back three or four times. And, you know, and then you get these stars, international stars like Brian Cox came to our show in London. And there's a reason why we sell out. And that's because we have a very good, funny brand. Festivals around Australia are wanting to book us and around the world. Yes. And it's amazing to be a part of this yarn and get to tour with people that you love. And it's been such a blessing to sow into all these deadly up-and-coming comedians. I sometimes have to pinch myself because, you know, I had a rough upbringing. I didn't grow up ideally. I come from dysfunction, come from domestic violence, grew up in a lot of ugly stuff. So I came a product of my environment. And then 22 years ago, I forgave my stepfather from a jail cell in New South Wales. And that was the catalyst of turning my life around. And then healing from that stuff and then be able to talk about your dysfunction and realise this is so much comedy gold here. And now I'm so focused and passionate about what I do. I'm being 52 this year and I know what you're thinking, black don't crack. But it's been such an amazing journey of ups and downs. But when you've got them good people around you and people that believe in you and also believing in yourself, it's been such an amazing time to give back now, give back.
You said right before we started our conversation, you weren't sure how you got booked to come on to, like, to come and talk to me.
Yeah, that happened.
So let me tell you, because what you've said is really relevant. Here on Away, we talk to all kinds of creative people, blackfellas making things and doing things. And I've spoken to a couple of comedians, and when I ask them who has been important to their career and helping them on their way, your name kept coming up as someone who has given people opportunities early on, taken risks on them as comedians, helped them develop their craft. And I don't know, I just, when I started thinking about who do I want to have this conversation with, I was like, well, that's the person that needs to be in the room.
Well, you know what? Big love. I don't know who's been, I get a lot, you know, like I don't like to name drop, but I love these people that I've helped, loved and supported. And you know, I've helped, loved and supported people through hard times. Right? When people wanted to throw in the towel. I said, no, this fire you're going through right now is good for you. It's going to refine you. It's going to make you stronger. So you're going to get through this, and then you're going to look back at this in a couple of years' time thinking, wow, I got through that. Because we all go through fires, sister. Mm. It's who you keep around you. Who's sowing into you? Who's picking you up? Who's checking in on you? And then if you've got a joke, let's run it past each other. Who do you trust? I trust my jokes with Shawnee, Steph Tisdale, Andy Saunders. You know, I throw my jokes out there with a lot of different people that I love and trust. And so it comes back to you. So, you know, there's been a lot of people that I think it's just him. And this is my mum, though. That's like, love your mum, Beryl. Love your mum, Rose. I've got two mothers. And they've sewed into me to be this person that I am now. So when I finally did throw off the trauma and found my healing and then turn my life around, my mum said, you know, now it's time to sow into you. For me, it's like being able to give to others and love people. And, you know, people know genuinely who's in your corner. And so to be able to be in the corner of so many beautiful, up-and-coming, deadly mob through comedy has been a real blessing for me. And now I see these people on starring in movies and on television shows, and I'm like, when they're winning, I'm winning.
Thank you all so much for yarning with me today about blackfella humour. This has been an absolute joy.
Oh, cool. Thank you for inviting us.
Well, Angelina, you're a star, and I just want to say to you, I love you. You're an absolute star. And I'm going to challenge you, and I want a verbal, commitment today. Will you do Deadly Funny next year?
Yes.
Oh, I
will work with you personally.
Yeah, come on. Verbal commitment. No. What do you say when you stand up there? I do. I do.
And it looks like the moment for Dr. Angelina Hurley to hit the Deadly Funny 2026 stage is finally here. You've been listening to the side-splitting trio, Dr. Angelina Hurley, Kevin Capinieri, and Janji Blair, as we yarn about the power of black humour, how it heals, teaches, and brings mob together. And if you're sitting there thinking your New Year's resolution might be to finally try stand-up, why not sign up for Deadly Funny, Australia's own dedicated Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander comedy competition. It's part of the Melbourne International Comedy Festival that runs from the 25th of March to the 19th of April. Last year, I got to yarn with Dinawan Baker, the winner for 2025, who took home the hotly contested title with Yindamada Johnson and Errol Strang named as runners-up. I spoke to Dinawan about his big win just as he touched back down in his home state of Queensland.
My name is Dinawan and I'm from the Biggumbull people. And when my grandfather talks romantically about our country, he calls it the old tree, pretty stone country.
Oh, gorgeous. Dinawan, what inspired you to take part in Deadly Funny?
Well, first of all, it was an opportunity that presented itself very quickly and out of nowhere, you know, as the impacts of the cyclone that just came through. And I rang up a friend, basically just checking in on him, you know, as you do when you go through an event like that. And so I was just checking in, and then he told me that he had gotten his new role and he was producing, you know, with the Melbourne International Comedy Fest and, more importantly, Deadly Funny. And I was like, bruh, that's so awesome. You know, you would suit that so well. And 2 days later, he rang me up and goes, hey, you want to have a crack? And that's how quickly it came about. So I said, yeah, let's do it. And so I went for it.
So, I mean, what went into your preparation for your set?
Well, you know, like most things, you have an idea of, you know, what could be, you know, a presentation. But you really, you know, you need to surround yourself with good people who are in that same way of thinking. And that was the thing about, you know, Deadly Funny and the coaches that they have, like Kevin Capinieri and Andy Saunders, is they put you in a place where they can help you elevate those ideas and give them birth. And so I basically just had an idea of what could be. And then with expert help, and surrounding myself with people who are in that same way of thinking, it really helped that material develop in such a short space of time.
I need to say congratulations, because you just this week were named the winner, the overall winner of Deadly Funny at the grand final at Melbourne International Comedy Festival. How did it feel?
Oh, it was just an awesome feeling, you know, like to actually put yourself out there. And as most people know, comedy is, you know, some of the hardest that you can do in, you know, in the arts industry. You're alone on stage. You know, it's just you and the audience. And, you know, you got to come prepared. You got to be, you know, ready for it, and can be very intimidating and very raw to expose yourself like that. So to step up into that space and to own that space and then be rewarded with the national title was just an awesome, awesome feeling.
Dinawan, it's interesting that you say that this is a really challenging art form, because I know that you are a visual artist as well. I'm curious about how you approach art broadly.
It's all environmental, you know, it's situational. And we come from a people and a culture that move and adapt to our environment. We've been able to do that for thousands of years. And so, you know, to step into a space, you know, whether it's going to be based around your art when you're putting, you know, paint onto canvas, or if it's a dance expression or you're singing, You know, it's about, you know, enjoying that space. So, and it's also putting yourself out there to be judged. So if you can get over the fact that people are going to judge you in their way, you know, whether it's, you know, in a good way or, you know, they're going to be critical of it, you know, it's about being comfortable to do that. And when you're comfortable with that and, you know, it doesn't, you know, phase you if you're going to get negative, but, you know, obviously you just, you take it all in when it's the positive. But it's about how you want to be, you know, represented, and not just for here and now, but further down the track. And you can create conversations that are awesome. And yeah, I really like that about the art industry.
And I think, because something that I've been speaking with Kevin Capinieri, Jaunty Blair and Angelina Hurley about is the way in which comedy can be used as a tool of resistance and resilience. And I think that is something that you're capturing here as well.
Oh, thank you. Well, you know, that's the thing. And at Melbourne especially, you know, because we know that down in Victoria when we have Indigenous issues and, you know, in events, we know that the Victorian crowd, you know, they're our allies a lot. You know, you'll see a street march with like 30,000 people in it. And, you know, they really promote that. They want to make change, and they do it, you know, by putting their feet on the street. And so to have that kind of event in Melbourne meant that, you know, in the crowd we had so many allies, and they were there and they listened to, like, our humour, our art. They got to experience, you know, our expressions, our emotions. And what happens with that is then when they go away and they start to talk about the event, even though they might get some negativity from some of their own community members or their own circle of people, you know, they're able to talk happy about that. And when they talk happy about that, that breaks down those barriers that were there before. And, you know, that's what humour, it can do. And to have Deadly Funny, you know, put people in a place for 2 or 3 hours where they're just saturated with this laughter and amazing emotions, it's beautiful to watch. And, you know, and then we know, even though we'll never be in that house where those conversations are taking place, that's really part of that healing. And Deadly Funny have been able to platform that in a way that I just wanted to support that and be around that.
Dinawan, did you always know that you were funny?
My kids tell me every day that I'm not, which is awesome now, because every time, and I'm going to use it, I'm going to drop dad jokes on them left, right and centre. And when they say, "Dad, you're not funny," I'm like, this trophy here says that I'm a national award winning, you know, comedian. So yeah, it's been proven by my peers. And, you know, I'll milk that. I'll tell you the truth. I'll milk that. But at the same time, you know, when my daughter was 12, so she was into jiu-jitsu and she won an Australian title when she was 12. So last night I was sitting with her, you know, we're just, you know, unpacking the events of what just happened. And I said, "Oh, bub, we've got another Australian title holder in the house now. I'm the new one. You can't have that title anymore." And she looked at me really casual and went, "Yeah, but Dad, I held that title for 7-something years. So, you know, let's see how long, the longevity of how long you go in the industry." And that's humbling and rewarding at the same time. And then she's like, "Are we sure we sent the right family member down for this competition?" And, you know, that just shows character, and it also shows that, you know, humour is in our house and will forever be.
Maybe we didn't send the funniest of the Baker clan.
Yeah, and I'm really happy, you know, that, you know, about that as well, because it just shows that it's a natural thing. Because, you know, growing up in our communities, in our families, we always had these characters in our household that would just, you know, be amazing storytellers, and they'd hold a space and they'd bring a humour and, you know, just happiness. And so for me to go down to Melbourne and compete, I just wanted to highlight those characters in our families and really bring them to life. And that's what Deadly Funny did. It allowed me to platform that. And yeah, I was just blessed to be there in that space.
That was Dinawan Baker, the 2025 winner of Deadly Funny. I can't wait to see who takes home the title this year. You're listening to Away on Radio National, and now it's time to hear some music recorded back in May 2025 with two members of the indie coastal punk quartet, the Betty Rays. Jackson Jacko Van Issum and Lewis Louis McKenna stopped by the studio fresh off the release of their second album, Do What You Wanna. The Betty Rays are known for crafting their music with live performance as the priority, designing their songs specifically for outdoor festivals and that communal experience. Here they are with an acoustic version of their song Red Lights, with Jacko on lead vocals and guitar, and Louis on guitar and backing vocals. It was recorded right here in the Away studio.
At times I don't fit in, just light a cigarette. Look how cool it is, breathe it in, the lights forget. It's not impossible, kicked every obstacle. I stumble and fall, I got my back against the wall. Someday I might regret bugging a spider web. I'm tangled to death and holding on to what is left. And red lights light up the dash while trying not to crash. I'll take these problems and break them and solve them. Some be good to me. I'm taking the slow route, all that I know now. Time is all I need. Now we're on the road now, maybe you'll find our feet. It's not impossible, kicked every obstacle. I stumble and fall and catch myself against the wall. Red lights light up the dash while trying not to crash. I'll take these problems and learn how to solve them. Some be good to me. I'm taking the slow route, all that I know now. Time is all I need. Now we're on our road now, maybe we'll find our feet. La da da da, la da 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 da. Now we're on our road now, maybe we'll find our feet. Now we're on our road now, maybe we'll find our feet.
And if you want to see the Betty Rays boys out in the wild this summer, you're in luck. They're hitting the road this month for a massive regional tour, kicking off in Queensland. Tonight, they're playing in Mackay. Later, they'll make their way around New South Wales, the ACT, Victoria, the Northern Territory, and Western Australia, right through to March. We'll have more info on our show page if you want to check them out. And that's our show for this week. Thanks for your company. Away was produced on Gadigal Country. Our technical producer is Simon Branthwaite. We'll be back next week, but in the meantime, you can always find us on the ABC Listen app, along with our titter program, Speaking Out, hosted by Larissa Berendt. Until next time, I'm Rudy Bremer. Yalu.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.